Fernando Ortega, and Children of the Living God, and before that, from Robin Mark, The Days of Elijah. It is 12 minutes past the hour. It's a Tuesday morning, and we greet Dr. Don Clark. Don is a biochemist and member of the Board of Creation Moments, and he joins us from Garden Valley, Texas, just about every Tuesday morning. We talk about scientific stuff. Don, good morning. How you doing?
Well, good morning. I'm doing well, but temperatures are rising here. We've had quite a lot of wind last night and this morning, and apparently even more to come.
I mean, like really strong winds.
Days ago. Yeah. What's that?
Like really strong winds? This poses a threat to the vineyard, does it?
Oh no, vines don't have any leaves on them, so they're not gonna break from the wind.
Okay.
But, it's a stark comparison to what we had just a couple of days ago when our pond had a little bit of ice over it.
Oh, really? A little bit of ice? Did you go ice fishing?
It wasn't. You couldn't get on the ice unless you wanted to sink.
Okay.
So it was just a very, very thin layer because we were down in the teens.
Heavens! Yeah.
And today we are in the 70s again.
I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear about that. 70s. Yeah. Looking at our conditions, we're 21 degrees, light snow, fog, and mist. We have a full bag of weather up here right now, and I think they're looking at about 4 inches of snow after about 3 inches yesterday. That means I'm shoveling again today.
Are you getting your exercise?
I'm getting something. Yeah.
Coming down out of the sky.
You know, I saw online. Dave and I both saw it. It was a slideshow of snowflake photography. Some Russian photographer had his own private setup on his apartment balcony, and he took exquisite photos of snowflakes. And I looked at those snowflakes and I'm saying to myself, I just shoveled millions of those and threw them away and stomped back in the house. I didn't even take a look at them.
You should have collected some on a microscope slide, a frozen microscope slide, and then looked at them under the microscope.
With my luck, I would have discovered two that were exactly alike.
You could have published that.
Yeah, it would have been a scientific finding. Well, this is kind of a scientific, well, not so much a finding, but our article today over at the Institute for Creation Research is entitled "The Catch in Creation." And it starts off with the history of Velcro, which one I thought was interesting. I've heard it before. But what it has to do, in fact, let me read you this, because there are a couple of Bible verses that pertain here. And first of all, Romans 1:20, I will quote from Paul's writings here. "From the very time of creation, men should have seen the evidence of God's existence and his work in the marvelous universe he had created. For God hath showed it unto them," is a quote. And they also quote from the Psalms, where it says in Psalm 19, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork." It's like this should be no great surprise, but scientists have a little different take on this thing. And what's the word for this this topic today?
Oh, biomimicry.
Biomimicry.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Biomimicry. Mm. And so you might... You might be wondering what is biomimicry, and it's when scientists or engineers look at something in nature and get an idea and say, hey, that's pretty neat, and then go on to develop develop a product or improve their existing products.
Mm-hmm.
We can cite many examples of that. Of course, Velcro is a popular one, where George de Menstrel, back in 1941, he was a Swiss engineer and a mountaineer, and liked to go hunting. So he took his dog and went hunting one day and came back with all kinds of cockleburrs on his clothes and on his dog. And of course, he had a hard time getting them off, as those of us that live in the South, we have a lot of these things.
Yeah, I've been there too.
And so he began to wonder. He said, "Why in the world is that sticking so strongly?" So he had access, I guess, to an electron microscope, and looked at the cockerbirds under the microscope, and he discovered that they had very, very tiny little hooks. And then he looked at his pants or the fabric of his clothes and said, oh, there's some loops. And it looked like the hooks were latching onto the loops of the fabric and onto the fur of the dog. He said, oh, that's interesting.
That's when the light bulb went on over his head.
Yes, and he said, wow, maybe we can make something with this. So he, with a local weaver, began to develop what is now known as Velcro. Vel meaning loops and cro meaning hook. We got loops and hooks joining together to form this material, this two-part material, which is used now in all kinds of things from, you know, we used to have to tie our shoes, but now you can get Velcro.
Some athletic shoes do that. Yeah. Know. Okay.
Yeah. Tennis shoes and things. And they've got Velcro in
games where you can throw stuff at a fabric and they stick, you know, balls in the target and stuff. It's kind of entertainment stuff. I understand the Velcro was actually developed, perfected maybe for this as part of the space program. I didn't mention
I think that's that may be. I'm not completely aware of that, but Menstrual actually made quite a lot of money off of the idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, once he developed it to a practical application, of course, then he sold the rights, and other folks have developed it even further. So you can make material that is. Obviously, small hooks or big hooks, and have different applications, all from looking at the cockle burl.
And I've learned that they're strong enough too to hang a small child on the wall. You can do that with Velcro.
If you have, if you have a lot of it, I guess, on the wall. Of course, you got to stick the Velcro to the wall, which is actually, you know, another substance, adhesive. Have you ever thought about adhesive? I mean, where did that come from?
Well, it used to come from like horses' hooves, the old wood glues, and I remember my old wood shop in school, this foul smelling kind of a yellow glucky stuff, and that's horse glue they would call it, and I don't know how that's probably like the original glue. But I think a lot of it, and shellacs and other paints come from like insect shells and insect parts. So science has made good use of nature in a number of areas, and they're still working at it. And I suppose with quantum physics, there's even more such discoveries ahead where they'll see a principle in nature. This is how this works. This is how light works, or this is how electrons spin, and they'll develop stuff off of that. That will just confound people and start new industries and new companies and change the way we live. I understand that even the microwave resulted when there was some experimental work going on with radio frequency generating magnetrons, and there was one of the technicians who had a candy bar in his pocket. He got too close to it and it melted. And that's when the light bulb went on over his head.
And he said, maybe I should
stand farther away. Yeah, but then another light bulb went on, and it led to microwave ovens for us. So, but we look in nature and we find these patterns and these methods that difficult things get accomplished, amazing things, and we are able to take them and do similar things by following those same principles. So, who do we give credit for this thing, this stuff?
Well, you would think that, you know, as you read that verse in Romans 1:20, that we would give credit to the Creator, not to the creation, but to the Creator. But unfortunately, oftentimes, you know, we give credit to the creation and say, oh, look, you know, look what evolution has developed. I mean, you can either look at something and say, wow, this is marvelously designed. The designer must be awesome. Mm-hmm. So if you have a biblical viewpoint or a creation viewpoint, you would look at the design and you would say, this is awesome. I mean, the person who designed this must have been, you know, is fantastic. And or you can look at it from an evolutionary point of view and say, wow, this took millions of years to develop. And over this millions of years, it was finally refined into what we see today. It just happened to, you know, it was just a happenstance, if you will. And, you know, which one is more satisfying, really? I mean, to look at we're not just looking at one thing. We're looking at everything in life. Everything that we see around us is perfectly designed for that which it was designed for. And it's not just a happenstance. I mean, you might say, okay, well, one of these things might have come about this way, but when you look at the myriad of thousands upon thousands of intricately designed things, everything from the molecular motor that you see in bacteria, for example, that have little tails or cilia, and you think, well, that tail is just wagging. It's not wagging. It's actually rotating, and it's rotating very, very fast, like 100,000 revolutions per minute. And it's powered by a little motor, a rotary motor that's in the cell wall of the bacteria. And it took us, you know, again, with the help of electron microscopes, we could then figure out, at least look at the pieces of this motor, and the pieces of the motor are all proteins and, you know, chemicals interacting. And we talked about ADP, adenosine triphosphate, which is the energy molecule within the cell. That's used to rotate the motor. So it's like you've got little sparks, and they fire as the rotor, rotates around the stator, and things in the engine works. The molecular engine works. Well, we have a hard time developing a rotary engine that rotates at 1,000 RPMs. Another example, of biomimicry. This has now become a complete field in science. I don't know if you noticed the transition in airplanes, where the tips of the wings were flat, mm-hmm. and then the medium-sized planes and the smaller planes, they started designing them with the tips of the wings, you know, pointing up.
Yeah, I just flew a couple of weeks ago, and I was marveling at that. I was aware of it before, but yeah, I did notice the transition, and I suppose that has to do with maybe turbulence.
Well, the eddies that are formed at the tips of the wings. So some engineer or a group of engineers got the idea from watching birds. Watching eagles and stuff, and they in the tips, it's only the tips of their wings that kind of tip up, and then gives them, you know, more control and more stability. And so they tried this in the wind tunnel, and found out that, hey, you know, we can improve our efficiency, tremendously of our wings, just by having the tips of the wings go up. And, you know, again, something that you observed in nature, for example. When I was studying biochemistry and working in the biotechnology industry, we visited a lab that was looking at mollusk adhesives, for example, looking in to see if that could become a bio, adhesive.
How snails stick to things, right?
Yeah, how they stick to things. Yeah. And, it's something, it's a substance, actually. It's a protein it's got sugars attached to it, and it's excreted from the mollusk or from the shell, from the clam or whatever. And it, you know, it sticks tenaciously. I mean, we spend billions and, at least millions of dollars, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, scraping little critters off the hulls of ships that stay in the water too long because of this type of adhesive. So if we could develop either a method of easily removing them, or even using that type of adhesive, let's say, in the medical field, we would be, you know, it might be of great advantage. So, anyway, I had visited some researchers that were working with this and tried to figure out the molecular composition of this adhesive so that they might, you know, one day at least mimic it in some type of synthetic manner. So we have examples all throughout our, you know, the products that we see today that are mimicking things of, you know, things of life. And so if why don't we give the creator all the glory, because that's what we're supposed to do. I mean, we're supposed to look up in the heavens and say, wow, you know, there's a lot of stars up there, and they seem to be not randomly distributed throughout space, but they seem to be organized in some fashion. And if they're organized in some fashion, then there had to be an organizer, and we should give the glory to the organizer. And then as we peer down into the smallest realms of our world, certainly in biology now that we have the capability of looking at looking through with an electron microscope at the atomic level, I mean, we can see the individual atoms, much less the proteins, but we can see now down to the individual, you know, atom level, and see how things are arranged, and we can marvel at that, and you know, make adjustments in whatever it is that we're building. You know, I'm sure that, you know, folks are looking at things like this and trying to figure out how can we make computers more efficient. How can we pack more information into either the silicon chip or convert to, let's say, from electrons to light, and have light computers which would run significantly faster than even the computers that we have today. So, you know, we can gain all of this information, but we lack the ability, it seems, that of giving credit to where credit is due, and that is towards our creator.
You know what I think? I think scientists who work with these things, that discover these principles, the way things work, these incredible engineering examples, know in their hearts there's a God. I don't know how you can reach any other conclusion when you see his fingerprints all over the creation. And furthermore, it's not just the engineering. I should say it's not just the design. It's not just the rotor tail that spins at 1,000. But it's the purpose that it serves. It's a way to solve a problem, a most elegant way to get something done. Thinking back to Velcro, I mean, the fact that these burrs stick to your clothing, that's the way that the plant propagates. It moves around and it drops off eventually and grows a new plant. I mean, there was a purpose to that. It wasn't just an oddity that he discovered. He discovered something that was designed for a reason, and beyond the actual engineering, I mean, the problem solving is the amazing thing to me.
Well, absolutely. I mean, everything, you know, everything has a purpose. Every single thing has a purpose, and so everything that was designed by the Creator was designed perfectly for its function. And if we have an evolutionary mindset, we would say, well, it's almost there, but it's not quite there yet. You know, it still has to evolve a little bit. And maybe there'll be another great jump or leaps in evolution that will advance everything yet that much more. We have this idea that somehow by dying, we can actually produce something better than what was there originally. And unfortunately, if you look at things around us, even with our own bodies, for example, I mean, we're not getting better. I mean, you know, our bodies are slowly, with the accumulation of mutations, you know, they're not getting better. We're getting, you know, the design isn't improving, if you will. The design was perfect at creation, but we're slowly kind of wearing down, if you will.
Do evolutionists recognize that, though? Do they see superiority in the generations of creatures and critters that came before? Do they sense? Do they understand that it's degrading? That we're not what we used to be in a sense of the word?
It doesn't appear that way. I mean, they look at it from the exact opposite, that you know, things are improving, and we know, for example, that things are not improving from a biological point of view, at least. You know, what obviously man and his the knowledge that we accumulate over the years. We get more knowledge, and we can then use the knowledge to build better things, or bigger cities, or better transportation systems. And collectively, you know, you can look at that and say, "See how society is advancing."
Yeah.
At least in the material aspect. Well, and then you have to ask your question, you know, the question, is it really? Are we really advancing?
Yeah.
Are we really learning to live together any better than we did, you know, 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago?
I was talking to David a short while ago about my television experience last night. You know, we just put Netflix into the system because I've been avoiding them since their prices went up. And, you know, okay, I'll try it. But I've discovered a program, several programs I really enjoy. One of them is called Chef's Table. And I watched an episode last night about a chef in the Hudson River Valley who is dedicating his career to organic gardening and engineering new, not genetically modifying, but going back to the way fruits and vegetables and plants used to be cultivated, root crop rotation and so forth, to undo the engineering that's been done by genetically modified organisms, by GMOs. And he's saying we should engineer food for taste, because industry has come in and engineered food for huge quantities and shippability, so you can ship it around the world and it won't spoil. Science has built certain criterion into seeds to plant crops, but have no regard for either taste or nutrition. And he's saying we should be breeding back in the other. We should be going back to the way it was. And he's developed some new plants. A small squash, for example, which is like a butternut squash, but it's about a tenth the size. And new wheat. And he's really big on wheat in particular. So to get rid of all that garbage out there and get back to the way wheat used to taste. It's tasteless anymore. We've engineered all our bright scientific minds have engineered away taste. And so there's one sense in which we going backwards has been recognized as maybe the right way to go if we want food to taste like it used to taste.
Yeah, the theory of devolution is one of those things that makes sense when we talk about it, the three of us. And I was in a group setting I think it was a couple of days ago, and was just four or five guys standing around talking about something, and I don't remember where or when. What might have been a church, but you know, they were giving examples of how they're you know, people are not as smart as they used to be. What look at those incredible, amazing ancestors that we had, and what the wonderful things that they came up with. And then I threw out this idea of we're getting dumber, we're not getting smarter, and there was a stunned silence. You know, that, there wasn't the automatic pushback. There wasn't the, oh, this is nonsense, Dave. Oh, this is ridiculous. It's not like I was you know, making a passionate speech for the support of the Second Amendment. It was, they were stopping the thinking. I says, well, wait a minute. I just like, oh, this might be that moment, you know, over the last couple of years that Dave might be right this time. it was one of those moments, and then somebody changed the subject because this is, well, we don't want to leave the subject, you know, laying here, because it flies in the face of everything we've ever thought about, or everything we've ever thought about as far as what we've done to create this amazing place that we happen to live in, that, you know, might have been created by somebody else, but we actually did it ourselves. You know, it's one of those aha moments where the group suddenly said, "Oh, yeah, that's right."
Well, sort so of, you should have given Dr. Don full credit at that point.
Yeah, at least I got to think about it some more. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's so it was an interesting experience. You know, and we talk about it quite a bit, and we can find examples of it going on, you know, among the three of us. You know, the rest of the world hasn't caught up yet, but, you know, they will.
And another story that's applicable here, I'm just looking this up to confirm what I thought I knew, and it has to do with the origin of aspirin. And it reads here in Wikipedia, although aspirin's origin was in academic research, and Bayer, he was a scientist working in Germany, was not the first to produce it commercially. Bayer insists that the active ingredient in aspirin, acetylsalicylic acid, was synthesized for the first time in a chemically pure and thus stable form in 1897 by a young chemist working for Bayer. His name was Dr. Felix Hoffmann. And that's when they started manufacturing aspirin in various forms, tablets and powders. But they had aspirin working back in ancient Greek times. They obtained acetylsalicylic acid from willow bark. They knew it cured headaches and made people feel better. This is more mimicry, I think, in learning how to commercially produce it to make a synthetic acetylsalicylic acid and come up with aspirin. So once again, they looked at nature and said, hey, this works for that. Let's see if we can replicate it using our own technology, and then we'll take credit for it. You know, aspirin was the miracle.
We'll forget about the old stuff that was done many, many years earlier by perhaps even, to tie the two conversations together, even smarter men than we have today.
And aspirin, by the way, was patented. So I'm wondering if maybe God should have taken out patents on all these processes and products that he disposed.
Yeah, well, that has been a conundrum in the patent industry, if you will, because if you look at a protein, for example, and you sequence a protein and then you make the protein, can you patent the sequence?
Good question.
And the obvious answer is, well, of course not. You know, you didn't design that or create that. That was a product of nature, or God designed it, if you will. But they don't say that, of course.
Yeah.
So they make a slight modification, and they say, okay, now we've come up with a new invention. And so you get patents on insulin, which is just a protein that has a specific function, which we've learned to make use of, obviously, in diabetes. But why would you be able to patent penicillin, for example? I mean, why patent penicillin? Because penicillin was discovered in a petri dish. Because a certain bacteria and moles, the penicillin, organism, I think it was a fungus, had this property of preventing any bacteria from chewing it up.
And I don't think you can patent a discovery, can you?
No, I mean, it's a biological thing that's already there, and then you go and look for the the product, and say, well, maybe I can make use of the product here that's being produced by this mold, and that's exactly how penicillin came about. And so it was a kind of a freak discovery, and then we made use of it. So there's over the eons of time, if you will. there's been discoveries, like the discovery of the battery. I mean, who was the first to discover the battery?
I should know that. I studied that stuff. David, help me, David.
Seymour Everetti.
No, I don't think it was like Volt or
you would think that it, you know, it happened relatively recently, at least within the past 100 years. The Egyptians had batteries.
I didn't know that.
The Egyptians developed the battery.
Yeah.
And the technology was lost and then rediscovered. And, you know, the person that rediscovered it, you know, makes a lot of money.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of things happened in ancient Egypt. They had a lot of smart folks. So
we did never seem to give credit where credit is due, do we? Whether it's to the ancients or to the Creator himself.
Exactly. Yeah, it's very, very difficult. And I think a big reason for that is this thing within us called pride that the enemy uses and stirs up. And it was pride that obviously caused, you know, Satan himself, Lucifer himself, to fall out of grace, you know, from God, because he wanted to be God. And that's the same process that's going on today.
Well, it's the essence of humanism, and that's the enemy. That's the enemy. We're talking with Dr. Don Clark, biochemist, and again, a member of the board at Creation Moments. And Creation Moments, by the way, has a marvelous website. In fact, there's a brand new website being developed for Creation Moments that will be unveiled here in a month or two. But for the time being, you can link to the existing website from our website. If you're listening on BrokenRoadRadio.com this morning, over to the right-hand page, right-hand of the homepage, there's a Creation Moments icon there. Click on that. It'll take you there. And you'll discover just a wealth of materials that have to do with the science that supports the biblical creation story. And we're talking essentially science. It's not so much theology, not so much philosophy, not so much history. It's science. The article that we're talking about today on biomimicry, there's a link in the chat window. You can go to the Institute of Creation Research and read about that too. Lots of things happening in science that just undeniably point to the Creator, and the one to whom should go the credit. And that's what our story is about today: biomimicry, the catch in creation, over at icr.org. Don, thanks very much for joining us. It was good to have you along today, and I think we learned something.
Well, very good. I hope so.
Yeah, that's the idea. Even David learned something today.
I think I did.
I think so. Don, have a terrific week, and we'll catch you next Tuesday, okay?
Okay. You folks, too.
Take care. Bye-bye.